Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are joined by Princeton professor Julian Zelizer, who is out with a new book, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Julian, you're sort of everywhere these days with this book.
I am. I'm enjoying it very much. And it's always just an honor to be able to speak about something you've worked on. So I love being busy. And thank you for having me on this show.
Well, it's interesting because you really do trace the toxicity of our politics, the weaponization of language, the attacks on institutional integrity. You trace it back to the Gingrich era, and it's a very persuasive theory. So let me ask you this: did you start working on this book before Trump?
Yes, I started. It's a story that the downfall of Jim Wright that I had followed or touched on in books for decades now. And I'd also written about Gingrich and that era of Republican politics, essentially how a lot of the reforms the Democrats passed after Watergate to make Congress better actually became methods and a platform for Republicans to move toward a takeover. So these are things I thought about. I actually started writing the book really during the Obama years, and I was following the Tea Party and the kinds of politics I was watching. And I thought, well, this is the moment to look at how Gingrich moved from being an outsider, a maverick, into being part of the Republican leadership.
Okay, well, what I wanted to start off with, getting your take on where we're at right now, and get your thoughts about the president's speech at Mount Rushmore, which of course has generated a huge amount of debate on the right and the left. This is what President Trump had to say over the weekend during his July 4th quote unquote celebration at Mount Rushmore.
We are now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Now, that language is really quite distinctive coming from a president. But one of the points I think you make very powerfully in the book is this can be traced back to Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, you know, a lot of that language is the language that Newt Gingrich introduced to American politics and actually encouraged other Republicans to use to describe their opponents. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, throughout his career, really from a very early moment, he believed in just dropping all the barriers or getting rid of the guardrails in terms of what you say about your opponent, what Republicans should say about Democrats in his mind should be blistering, because that was the only way to paint them in a way that would make them vulnerable. And as soon as I heard the Trump speech, I thought of a paragraph in my book where it comes at the end of the book, where in 1990, GOPAC, which is this organization that Gingrich controlled and used to communicate with other Republicans, they sent out a memo to fellow Republicans, I think it was in 1990. And it says, if you're a Republican candidate and you think, I wish I could speak like Newt, they recommend words to use. And the words are, describe Democrats through words like corruption, traitors, sick, shame, pathetic. And all of that came out of the vocabulary that Gingrich spent much of the 80s using. And so he turned up the heat in terms of what was permissible to say about Democrats and even about some Republicans. And I think there's a change that takes place, which is very relevant to the kinds of words you hear from President Trump.
The New York Times review of your book is When American Politics Turned Toxic, and describes Gingrich as the lead assassin in the murder of bipartisanship and effective governance. Do you think he was the lead assassin? And if so, how was he able to get away with it?
Well, he was very interesting, and this was revealing in his congressional papers, in that he explicitly talked about this all the time. And when he was early in his career in the early 80s, he would write these memos to the Republican leaders, people like Bob Michael, who was the House Minority Leader from Illinois, And he would say, enough with bipartisanship and enough with civility. All that those do is they allow Democrats to retain control of the House and of Congress. And we have to abandon those principles if we're ever going to achieve power. And we have to do things which will clearly and knowingly destroy the possibility for those ever happening. And he's explicit about this, and he works over the years to convince Republican leaders to stop being so concerned about that. And he's effective in part because his tactics work, and Republicans start to get a taste for power, and Gingrich is appealing in that way. So I think it's very important. And then the kind of politics he actually employs, it's not just the words, but what he does makes bipartisanship really a fleeting fantasy in Washington.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Bob Michael, because you really can't imagine somebody more different than Newt Gingrich, sort of mild-mannered, centrist, institutional Bob Michael, but also somebody who seemed to be very well suited to be the minority leader. And as you point out, Newt Gingrich not only juiced the Republican tactics, but he brought them to power. And it's hard to overstate, isn't it, the significance of that 1994 Republican Revolution, because they'd been out of power in Congress for 40 years. You have to go back to 1954. So there was an entire generation of people in politics who never could imagine not having a Democratic majority in the House. Newt Gingrich leads them from the wilderness to the promised land. So that was an amazing moment in American political history, and obviously empowered Gingrich in a pretty dramatic way.
That's exactly right. And even before he's Speaker, in the years I follow, this is already his appeal. Republicans, most of them, believe they were just a permanent minority. They hadn't been in power for so long. It was hard for them to imagine controlling the chamber. People like Bob Michael thought the best strategy was to negotiate and was to try to find ways where Republicans could be relevant in policy negotiations, so that they weren't literally just an irrelevant force on Capitol Hill. And all of this became that much more important after 1980, because Reagan is elected, and Reagan is promising a revolution in terms of policy and philosophy. The Senate goes to the Republicans in the 1980 election. So the House has become not just the last bastion of Democratic control, but in some ways the last bastion of liberalism. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Republicans really saw the problem. But Gingrich offers them something which I think many understood was dangerous as an alternative. And I titled the book Burning Down the House for a reason, because that's what Gingrich said was going to have to be done if they were going to rebuild it. And so it was a trade-off that people like Bob Michael had in front of them. Do we listen to this guy who's offering us the possibility of power, or do we stay focused and concerned about issues like governance?
You're critical of the media becoming an unwitting accomplice to what he was doing. Newt Gingrich, pre-Trump, figured out a way to always have the spotlight shining on him, and the media went along with it.
No, that's true. He's pretty masterful in terms of understanding what the media was about by the 1980s and how to use it. And there's different parts of the media. He sees C-SPAN, for example, which is a new cable channel. The House had just allowed cable or cameras onto the floor in 1978. And he sees that cable can be this incredible platform for him. And in 1984, he and a group of fellow conservatives would start going on the floor at the end of every working day once the chamber was empty. And they would make these blistering speeches about the Democrats being weak on defense and failing to support Reagan's war against communism in Central America, and calling out specific Democrats to answer the charges. And if you were watching on C-SPAN, it sounded like no one had an answer to what he was saying, but viewers couldn't see that there was no one in the chamber. It was totally empty at the end of the day. And Gingrich understood how the theater of that and the kind of language he used about the Democrats would be very effective. In the end, the speaker at the time, Tip O'Neill, gets so mad, he turns the cameras on the chamber and shows it's empty on live television. But even then, Gingrich uses it. He says, look, Speaker O'Neill is violating the rules, which say only the person speaking should be shown on camera. He's an autocrat. He's corrupt. And even more important, at the end of one of those days, all three major news networks covered what was going on C-SPAN, this controversial fight that was taking place, and Gingrich was on national television. So that's one example of how he saw and exploited the possibilities of the new media. He also saw investigative journalists after Watergate who were trying to uncover corruption and trying to tease out the relationship between politicians and money and lobbyists, how their work could be used not as a source of information, but as a partisan cudgel. Mm-hmm.
So you also describe in the history, and this, the nuance I think is really powerful in all of this, is that when the Democrats were in charge, they there was a certain arrogant swagger, and they bullied the minority Republicans. They deprived them of staff. They excluded them from some of the committee deliberations. There was Democratic gerrymandering and all of that. And Gingrich exploited that, didn't he, in order to get moderates to empower him?
That's exactly right. I mean, there's differences in the kind of partisanship is not new. It's really the kind of partisanship that Gingrich practiced. But Democrats were tough with Republicans, and Jim Wright was a tough partisan, and this is part of what made him vulnerable or made Gingrich appealing. When Jim Wright, who's an old school Texan, is the majority leader in the 1980s before becoming speaker, he kind of ruled with a firm hand. And he understood early on that, you know, Gingrich was a problem, and Gingrich and his cohort of Republicans were trying to, make a mess of things. So at key moments in my story, he tries to use the power of the majority to stop Gingrich from the kind of theatrics that he was engaged in. But one result of his kind of governing with a heavy hand was a lot of Republicans got frustrated, and they started to be more open to Gingrich's arguments that people like Jim Wright were not playing fairly. There was a whole battle over a seat in Indiana's 8th district, a contested election in 1985, where Gingrich used that moment to really try to make the claim that the Democrats just didn't play fairly. And when Wright becomes speaker in 1987 and is determined to unite the Democratic majority and to make sure that they could push back against the Reaganite Republicans, many Republicans start saying, okay, well, maybe Gingrich's approach is it's not tasteful and it's dangerous, but maybe that's just what we need right now.
Yeah, and as you write, Gingrich essentially said, you know, we have to shut down Congress. Republicans have to put aside their concern for governance until they regained power, right? So in other words, you know, that they would, you know, try to persuade people that the Congress had become morally, intellectually, and spiritually corrupt. Those were Gingrich's word, and that in order to overthrow the speaker, pretty much anything went, right? All means were permissible, including blowing up all of the norms, destruction of reputations, you know, calling people corrupt, including things like shutting down the government. So it really was the moment at which governance became much less important than winning some sort of a partisan war.
And that's exactly right. And I think that's what made Gingrich so lethal, because he prioritized partisanship so much, and because he really was willing to make the trade-off you just discussed. Once you're in that mindset, you'll do just about anything. There's very few limits on kind of how far you will go. And Gingrich, more than any other politician of that era, was constantly willing to go there, to go to the places other politicians were scared of going, to go to the areas that really were reserved for the Joe McCarthys of American history. But to say we can do that as the leaders of the Republican Party, not simply as the, you know, people on the sidelines. And that was a shift in mentality that I think we're still living with today.
You, one of the most difficult questions to deal with is the question of, you know, where did Trump come from? Was Trump inevitable? Was this some sort of secular inevitability of the Republican Party? And I'm still quoting from Jeffrey Cabanis's review that you reserve some of your harshest critics for the Republican Party leaders who naively believe they could harness Gingrich's insurgency. He acidly observes that while Republican gatekeepers of the early 1950s used Joseph McCarthy to attack their opponents, they never made the renegade senator their leader. I thought that was really an interesting point. Joe McCarthy might have been a cudgel, but they were never crazy enough to put him in charge.
Well, that was one of the findings of the book for me as I looked at this story and tried to understand how this happened that I didn't fully grasp when I started it. And there's different moments in the book where you see the leaders, the Republicans who had played by different rules, they're tempted by the fruit of Newt Gingrich, and they let him into the doors. Bob Michael, who we've discussed, even though he is certainly far from a Newt Gingrich in terms of his politics, does start to put out studies for the Republican Party that echo the themes that Gingrich is using about the corrupt Democratic majority and allows Gingrich to do what he's doing. The key moment when Speaker Wright is in the throes of this scandal, a position opens up for House Minority Whip, which listeners might not know if you're outside of Washington. It's a relevant position in the leadership. It puts you on a path to becoming Speaker. And once it's vacant, Gingrich runs for it. This is in 1989. And many reporters say, how would the Republicans ever elect someone like Newt Gingrich to this? And his opponent's a guy named Ed Madigan, who's also an Illinois old school Republican. But Gingrich wins. And he wins with the support not only of very conservative Republicans, but people like Nancy Johnson and Olympia Snow. They decide that he offers them a path to reclaiming the majority. And so they make this deal. And even George H.W. Bush, who's vice president and he's running in 1988 with Lee Atwater running his campaign, at a key moment in May of 1989, right as the story is reaching a climactic moment, on the campaign trail, he starts to talk about Jim Wright and he starts to bring in the Gingrich stuff to his campaign because it's a way to counteract Michael Dukakis, his opponent, who's saying he's part of a corrupt administration. And Bush uses Wright to say, look, the Democrats are corrupt too. So all these leaders pick up on what Gingrich is doing, and they literally elect him to be one of the leaders. And that's a transformative moment and a big difference with what we saw before.
Well, I remember what a surprise that was. And that really was a turning point. But again, in 1989, nobody ever imagined that he would actually become the speaker in 1994. Okay, so for some readers, your history is going to feel a little bit revisionist, because my impression always was that Jim Wright was kind of a corrupt, sleazy guy. You paint a very different picture of him.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't say he's an angel. And part of my book is Democrats had failed to clean up Washington enough after Watergate, so they left themselves vulnerable to these kinds of charges. But Wright wasn't found to have violated any ethics rules. He wasn't found to have violated any laws. There are these two issues of all the issues that Gingrich raises which stick the most. One is that Wright sold this book that he published of speeches and short pieces, and he sold them in bulk to big associations, interest groups where he would speak. And it was a way around the ethics rules of the 70s, which limited how much people could earn for speaking. You couldn't earn too much in honoraria, but you could earn as much as you wanted selling books. And so he and other legislators would sell books. But this story became one of the focal points of Gingrich's attack. And then B, he had a friend and was in business, a legal business, with a real estate developer back from Fort Worth named George Malik. And Gingrich used this to argue that basically this real estate developer was benefiting from Wright, and everything he did somehow helped his economic coffers. And Wright was definitely, you know, it might have been poor judgment to not think about how this would look to the public, but he didn't break any laws. He didn't formally violate any ethics. The ethics committee had not really completed much of its investigation before he steps down. And Gingrich criminalized him. He turned him, he said he's the most corrupt speaker in American history. So he took these small issues, these areas of gray that affected many members of Congress, and he turned them into another Watergate. And that was really the brilliance of what Gingrich did, but also why it was so devastating.
And Wright didn't really see it coming, right? He thought that he didn't understand that the rules of warfare had changed. He thought that you would, that the Congress would be run by a gentleman's agreement, that certain norms would be followed. And Gingrich just shattered all of that.
No, that's right. And that is another interesting part of the saga, that Wright keeps offering through his lawyers very technical explanations, for example, of why the things Gingrich was accusing him of and then the House Ethics Committee was investigating, they weren't true. The ethics rule said this, I didn't do this. But that was not how this was being conducted. The battle was taking place in the media. The battle was taking place in who could create a better narrative about what Wright had done. And Gingrich was very effective at this. And then equally important, I have a poignant moment at the end of the book, which people in Washington will remember, when Wright decides to resign. In May of 1989, Democrats are pressuring him to step down. They're saying, we're scared of what you will do to our party if you continue to be speaker. And he makes this speech, a one-hour speech on the floor of the House, which is a great piece of oratory. And he goes through every different claim against him and says it's not true, and he explains why in detail. And then at the end, he asks both Democrats and Republicans to stop, and he warns them that if we don't stop what this is doing, that the chamber will dissolve into mindless cannibalism, he said, and Washington will be destroyed. But what's remarkable, as much as the words that he used, was the fact he thought by resigning he would solve this. And he thought by giving himself up in some ways, Gingrich would stop. But Gingrich had no intention of stopping. In fact, once Wright is gone, he instantly releases a list of more people he wants to go after for ethics. And that was just a judgment where I don't think Wright understood how politics had changed or the direction it was moving. And it cost him his career for sure. But it also is why his solution of resigning really didn't do much.
Why didn't Democrats stand by him?
Well, that's another imbalance in the parties. They could have. There was no reason that Jim Wright had to resign. And that's one of those parts of American history where things could have gone in a different direction. Democrats could have said, we're not going to ask him to resign. We're not going to whisper to the media we want him to resign. We will stand by him. We don't have to vote. You know, if there's no vote, nothing was going to happen. And they could have seen what the Ethics Committee ultimately did. But they were scared. They were scared of what these new voices in the GOP were doing. Gingrich, Lee Atwater, Ed Rollins, who's warning that in 1990, he's going to make Jim Wright the focus of the entire Republican campaign. And they fold. And it's a contrast with Republicans, who I don't think would ever have done that. But had Democrats stood by Wright, had they protected him, it could have been a huge blow to Gingrich. And it might have actually pushed him to the sideline. So their decision mattered as well.
Yeah, and as you point out, Wright's decision to resign rather than cooling things off actually incentivized Republicans to ramp up their efforts to engage in even more brutal fights. So it really was the scalp that, and all the other Republicans looked at Newt Gingrich and thought, okay, maybe this is the guy. This guy brought down Jim Wright. Nobody else thought that was going to happen. And then, of course, he's elected in 1994.
It was a big deal, and it's one of these moments which is interesting when I speak to people who were in Washington at the time, reporters, politicians, everyone remembers this. And it was because it was the first time a speaker had resigned And it was a big thing to do. It was certainly Gingrich's biggest accomplishment politically in terms of delivering the goods. And so when this happened, it's not simply that the Democrats concede, it's that they legitimate. And this downfall of right legitimates what Gingrich was arguing. And it becomes important to who he is and the fact that he's more than rhetoric, that he can actually bring down the Democrats, as he will do again in 1994. So it's really quite an important moment in his career.
Okay, so let's fast forward. How do you get from Newt Gingrich to Donald Trump? Because I think this is one of the most important things about your book, is it says, if you have to understand, Donald Trump did not just appear one day. He's not a black swan event. You know, the ground had been prepared for him for some time. Republicans had been embracing this kind of toxic politics for some time. They'd become comfortable with questioning the patriotism of their opponents, of accusing everyone they didn't like of being corrupt, using words like traitor and radical. But still, how do you get from Newt Gingrich to Donald Trump? Do you have a map in your head how that happened?
Yeah, I do. I think once Gingrich his style of partisanship is successful and he's in the leadership, then his election as Speaker in '94 was a very important moment for Republicans of that generation. He's seen as a transformative figure, even though many people don't like him personally. Once again, as he did with Jim Wright, he delivers. The Republicans took over Capitol Hill for the first time since 1954. And so the methods he employed, which he continues to use as speaker, maybe people privately understood the risks, but people now were all on board with this kind of political style, not simply on Capitol Hill, but the way in which legislators and other politicians then used the media, including a new conservative media, to their advantage. And then you have a Tea Party revolution in 2010, where a new generation of Republicans come in, and they go even further than the Gingrich era. But they take that as the baseline and then accelerate what they're willing to do. And so by the time Donald Trump is running in 2016, the world of Republican politics had changed profoundly as a result of these two generations of Republican conservatives. And so I think there was a lot of reason why there was room for Donald Trump to win the nomination, to win the support of many Republican voters and retain it throughout his term. And to find a Congress, a Republican caucus that was basically willing to be by his side in the Senate. I think Senator McConnell, he is a product of this Gingrich mentality, do absolutely anything for partisan power. And Trump depends on that. So Trump comes out of this entire era, and he really makes sense if you think about it that way, rather than asking the question of how a reality television star ended up in the White House.
You know, you make an interesting point there about the conservative media, because, of course, 1994 was the apotheosis of conservative talk radio as well. And Newt Gingrich understood this, and the alliance that he had with Rush Limbaugh is, of course, you know, famous. And Rush was invited to speak to the Republican caucus after the victory. But you remember, you know, how much more the conservative media has grown since 1994. This is actually pre Fox News. So in some ways, he's established this model, this relationship between this new style of politics and a media that will support it. And then you multiply everything by 10,000 to where we are.
That's absolutely correct. There was no Fox News when Amazing. Gingrich did anything in my story, and there was no Fox News, when Gingrich becomes speaker. Fox News comes in 1996. I think Gingrich laid the groundwork in some ways for what Roger Ailes imagines as a successful conservative network. But it's also a reminder that Gingrich was equally interested in other forms of media, that he saw the mainstream media, even though he attacked it just like Donald Trump does, it's actually quite an important platform for him. And I think that's true of Donald Trump as well. So I think both parts of that story and the dating of this revolution before Fox television kind of opens our eyes a little bit to how this all came about.
So the farther you reach back to talk about the toxicity and the dysfunction in the Republican Party and its indifference to governing, by making this particular case, though, you also raise the possibility that when Donald Trump leaves, that this doesn't get fixed, that it really runs. If the roots are this deep, then the Republican Party is not going to snap back to some responsible governing minority or majority the day after Trump leaves office.
As the professor would say, correct, correct. That is the point. And once again, I didn't start the book thinking about Donald Trump. I never imagined he would be president of the United States. So I wanted to write a book about how the GOP had changed so profoundly and how it had become this party. And then Donald Trump came along. But for me, that means exactly what you're saying. I'm not one who's very confident that this is about a one-off, that it's just about the person in the White House. I am very aware of how he takes things to extremes and how there's parts of what he does that no other Republican would imagine doing. But the basic elements of his approach, the basic features of what we're seeing in the GOP right now are not going away. It's cooked. It's in the DNA of the party, all the way back to the 1980s.
And one of the indications of that would be the fact that we're even talking, there's speculation out there of Tucker Carlson running in 2024, which gives you an idea of, again, if you think that Trump is simply an aberration in terms of the Republican Party, why are we even talking about that?
We shouldn't be. I think it's a misplaced way to think about this. And then we're not taking seriously the history of how this happened and understanding the roots of where we are. I mean, if you step back to just think of how did, A, he win the presidency, and B, how did he sustain his support in a lot of the Republican Party despite everything he has done, which is, it's hard to even catalog anymore. You really have to ask the question of what's happened to the party and what is the party about. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense unless you think, you know, Republicans are all just hoodwinked and don't understand what's going on. I don't actually think that's the case. I think he fits in the modern Republican Party very well.
Okay, let's talk about what has changed, because Trump obviously has this has the playbook that we saw at Mount Rushmore going back to the Gingrich era, or maybe even earlier than that, back to 68 and 69 in 1970. Playing the race card, playing the patriotism card, all of that. He thinks, obviously, it will work. So far, as of today, there's no indication that, in fact, it is going to work. Give me your take on the Gingrich card, how it plays in 2020. Or have we reached the expiration date for that kind of politics, winning?
I'm not sure yet. I am one of the analysts who see the numbers, and I can see, okay, so here we are in July and Joe Biden's doing quite well, especially for a candidate who's barely visible to the public eye. And so that might suggest that Trump and his style of politics and the Gingrich era might be waning. Obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic, which is an added layer of life that might strain support for this kind of politics as opposed to when we have a growing economy. But let's see. We still have several months of campaigning left. And the lesson of Gingrich-style politics is you will do anything to win. Mm-hmm. And that means a President Trump can deploy all the power of the presidency in the next few months, from investigations to making a mess of the machinery of the elections to using that bully pulpit through social media in ways we're still not imagining, and hurt the Democrats and hurt Joe Biden. So I can still see a path to those numbers changing or to the dynamics of the election changing. I would not count Donald Trump out at all. And that's in part because of the real lessons of what I've just studied of what the party's willing to do.
Yeah. What worries you the most of those scenarios?
The election, I think, the Department of Justice and its investigative powers. I hate to think of it, but I don't know how that will be unleashed in the Biden orbit in the next few months. But most important is just making sure there's an integrity to the election in November. It's very concerning that we're in the first wave of a pandemic. It's surging in all these states, and we still haven't really fixed how is voting going to work to make sure we have high levels of turnout. And I'm very concerned that nothing's really happening on that front. And now it's almost too late to ensure that across the different states, everyone can vote one way or another, mailing it in or in person if they want to.
Yeah, I worry about the same thing. Julian Zelizer, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast. The book is Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. It is a great read. And in order to understand what's happening now and how we got here, I think that it is a crucial volume. So thanks again for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.